On today's podcast, we're going to be discussing the Netflix series Making a Murderer, and we're going to be talking about all of the details from the 10 episodes of that series. So if you haven't watched the episode yet, this is not the podcast for you, but if you have, or if you don't plan on checking it out, or you don't mind any potential spoilers, then go ahead and check this one out. Should be a good show. Making a Murderer on Netflix is over, but we are just getting started talking about the 10-episode Netflix series, which is taking the internet by storm, Making a Murderer. I'm Rob Cicerino, and we have a very fun, well, I don't know if it'll be fun, but it's definitely going to be a very interesting conversation about this very serious case, which is explored in Making a Murderer. And I'm excited to have two guys on here to talk about it here with me. Of course, you guys may know Akiva Winokur. He is my co-host on the Seinfeld post-show recap. And he is also a former professional researcher. He has been on top of this case since before this series even broke. Akiva, are you there?
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Akiva, I was trying to think if there's any similarity between Making a Murderer and Seinfeld. And I feel like they both have a similar ending.
Yeah, unfortunately. But, you know, who knows? Maybe everyone will get out of jail in due time.
Maybe. And then also joining us is somebody who is a longtime friend of Akiva's and somebody who I've gotten to know through doing the Seinfeld podcast with Akiva, that he is a lawyer who has graduated from Harvard Law School. His name is Alexander Chester, and he is also a big fan of the show and has been following this case. Additionally, Chester, are you there?
Indeed, I am.
Very excited to have you guys both here. Chester, how are you doing?
I'm doing better than Stephen Avery.
Yes. Well, Stephen Avery right now, I mean, I feel like that Stephen Avery, you know, 10 years ago, not doing great, but I kind of feel like Stephen Avery has got to be riding high a little bit right at this point.
Well, I mean, he's still in jail and is representing himself.
But not for long, right? I mean, he's going to be, it seems like that there is a lot of a big groundswell. Just kind of like where, you know, Adnan Syed, a year before Serial started, was probably not doing as good as like once Serial got rolling.
Yeah. I wonder, is he, you know, like we know that Brendan has lawyers who are trying to introduce his case into federal court in Wisconsin. And we can talk about sort of the benefit of federal court versus state court. But Stephen, there's like a lot of groundswell of support, as you said, but is it practical support? Like, for example, I've seen like 200,000 people have filled out petitions to the White House asking Obama to, well, first, you know, Obama can't do anything because they're in state court, not they're in prison for a state crime, not a federal crime. So there's no way Obama could commute their sentence anyway or pardon them. So in other words, a lot of the things that people are doing to sort of help Stephen Avery or that they think are doing practically aren't helping Stephen Avery. So the only thing that would practically help him is if he would be appointed, you know, competent counsel who could, you know, make an argument why his case should be heard either in federal court or that new evidence is introduced or something like that. But so in other words, he might be feeling better about himself, but he's still in jail with no realistic hope of being released anytime soon.
All right. Well,
there actually is breaking news, guys, yes. Where just today, one of his lawyers, Dean Strang, said that he has been talking about maybe representing him again. And, you know, who knows in what, I mean, there has to be some sort of case for that to even happen. But, you know, he would have no shortage of representation if, maybe somebody, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the first step is.
No, I think you're right, Akiva. Yeah. If there's a case to be made, it's high profile enough now that a lot of lawyers would probably want to take this on pro bono or organizations, things like that.
Yeah, somebody, some superstar would want to come in and get involved just for the halo effect of working on the Making a Murderer case. But we're going to start off, I think, today talking a bit about the show and its widespread appeal and maybe why this happened. And then we can get more into some of the nitty gritty and the parts of this case and where you guys ultimately have landed in your beliefs and opinions about this case. And really, we're going to spoil just about everything associated with the case. So if you haven't seen it by this point, I'll make sure I put a disclaimer at the beginning of the show. But we're talking about anything at this point, right?
We already said he's in jail, so I feel like
pretty much a spoiler.
That ship has
sailed. As it gets. Okay, now Akiva, you were the first person to tell me about this show, probably about a week or two before it dropped on Netflix. How did you know that Making a Murderer was happening?
I think it was when I watched Master of None, I'm like, what else does Netflix have going on? And I went to their Wikipedia page and I saw, in their documentaries, Making a Murder. I'm like, what's that? And I clicked on it, and I did a little Googling, and I saw that it was coming. And then maybe 10 days before it came out, I saw the trailer, which was incredible. And, you know, I made sure not to Google anything about the case, but I knew immediately that this would be, you know, the next serial.
Okay. And Chester, how did you end up hearing about it? Was it from Akiva?
I don't think so. I know Akiva mentioned it to me, but I think I read an article about it previewing it somewhere. It was the New York Times or something like that. But it was a couple weeks before it came out also. But I definitely, like Akiva, I wanted to watch it right away. Although I think Akiva pounded out all 10 episodes in like the first 24 hours upon release or something like that. Because I know it was like 3 days after it was released and I still had 3 episodes to go. And Akiva was like angry at me that I hadn't seen the whole thing yet. So
and Akiva, what was it about this as opposed to like something like Serial that really hooked you in?
Well, I'm a big true crime fan. I like reading books about true crimes and you know, I just read something about like the Manson family and things like that. And I don't know what it is about them. Like the mind of a serial killer or a killer or a potential killer doesn't really interest me, but just the general story for some reason does. And I'm a really big fan of a very similar documentary series called The Staircase, which came out like over a decade ago. And it's almost the inverse story of Making a Murder. And I do recommend anybody who's listening to this who liked Making a Murder go back and watch The Staircase now. So this type of thing has always been, something I'm into.
And just in case that there are some sadists out there that did not watch Making a Murderer and are listening to this podcast and don't know what it's about, it's basically the story of Stephen Avery, who went to jail at some point in the 80s for a rape case. He was imprisoned for 18 years before some DNA evidence ultimately released him in the early 2000s. Where then Stephen Avery was suing Manitowoc County for his wrongful imprisonment. And around that same time, when it looked like he was going to be getting himself a large financial settlement, there was a woman, Teresa Halbach, who disappeared, where Stephen Avery was the last person that she saw. And after a thorough investigation of Stephen Avery's property, then some remains of her were found, and then there was testimony from the nephew of Stephen Avery, a young man named Brandon Dassey, that sort of really put Stephen Avery in the right place at the right time and said he was torturing her, and they found evidence where he went to trial and was ultimately convicted of the murder of Teresa Halbach. And this story is about the defense of Stephen Avery, mostly in that trial of the murder of Teresa Halbach, and eventually gets into the trial of Brendan Dassey as well. So that is what Making a Murder is about. And so, Akiva, why do you think there's been such a buzz about this?
I think the reason something like this and Serial becomes popular is if it's a did they or don't they. If this was a slam dunk case that, you know, he either 100% did it, and the story is of a guy who got out after 18 years, and, you know, commits another crime, and, ooh, that's scary. That's maybe a, you know, one part doc, you know, story or a two part documentary. And if it's the opposite, where he gets out, even if he gets out a second time, this isn't nearly as popular, you know, if he had already been out, you know, pretty quickly after. But the idea where you can really debate and research, in real time, what's happening, very similar to Serial, where, you know, the people who were making the media here, only, you know, two people are in this case, or in some other case, like a team of people. And, you know, the internet as a whole may have more resources than them. It's also an interesting thing to debate. You know, do you think he did it? You know, what do you think happened if he didn't do it? There's just, you know, we could talk about this case for 20 hours. The possibilities are endless.
So I completely disagree with Akiva there. I think that the reason, first of all, so Akiva mentioned The Staircase, which is something that he turned me on to and which I watched a few months ago after I'd seen The Jinx. And I think The Staircase is the best of all of these types of shows. The Jinx, obviously, on HBO is what a lot of people have compared this to, and Serial and Making a Murderer. If you sort of look at those four, I don't think this is a mystery or a whodunit at all. At least the way the show is presented, there's no mystery. Like somebody joked earlier, one of you guys said, oh, well, we already said he's in jail. But there's no question that he's going to be in jail. There's no, it's not like in episode four, you're like, oh, is he going to be found guilty? Like the way this show is presented, fairly or unfairly, is this is a story of the injustice of the American legal system. This is a story, according to the documentarians, where somebody is clearly not guilty and has been unjustly put into prison. And I think the reason it became popular Obviously, Serial and the Jinx sort of popularized these kinds of things. But the difference is that Serial, in the first season of Serial, we never really know one way or another whether he did it or not. And there's a lot of debate there. The Jinx, we know the entire time that he did it. And so the only question is, you know, will he get in trouble for it? And there's sort of, obviously they have the bombshell at the end of that. I won't spoil that. And this one is sort of like the Jinx. There's no question about guilt or innocence, really, at least the way the show presents it. It's just, it's really more of an expose on the injustice of the American legal system. And so I think the reason it became popular is obviously those other shows sort of whet the American appetite for these kinds of shows. But also, frankly, anything Netflix does is popular. But also, I think it's in the context of sort of like the Black Lives Matter movement of the last 15 months, where there's been a number of cases of police officers shooting people and not being found guilty. And there's this sort of this idea that if, for example, if you're a minority, especially in this country, that the legal system, that the justice system is biased against you. And that if you're a police officer, it's biased in your favor almost no matter what you do. And I think this show plays into that while making the argument that it's not just an issue of race. It's an issue of class, because everybody in this show is white, but there's a difference between the people who are sort of pillars of the community and are educated. And then obviously there's the police and then there's the Avery family, who are poor, sort of, to use a politically incorrect term, they're white trash, they're rednecks. And so I think that that's part of what has made this show appealing to a lot of people, to show, well, it's not just a black white issue, but really it's an issue that affects people. You know, even if you're not black, this is important to you for the following reasons.
Just to nitpick a little bit, where you said there's not really a question so much of the guilt or innocence of Steve Avery, I think that from the legal perspective, I think that there's no question that he's going to be found guilty. But I think that the show does uncover a lot of evidence that makes the audience feel as though he is wrongfully accused a second time. And that there have been some critics of the show who feel like that hasn't been all of the evidence portrayed.
This is really the biggest issue with the series, in which case, and not to make this an endless comparison to sort of what we'll now call the Mount Rushmore of true crime stories, The Jinx, The Staircase, Making a Murder, and Serial. But when you listen to Sarah Koenig, like, she goes so out of her way as a journalist not to give her opinion. And you know, towards the end, maybe she's leaning, you know, 60-40 towards he did it, because as they say at the end, like, oh, there's just too many coincidences that would have had to add up for Adnan. But here they have such a distinct point of view. And it's almost like if you watch a sports team puts out a highlight video at the end of the year and they only show the games they won and they never show the games they lost. That's a little bit what this documentary becomes after the first episode, which is oddly balanced and in hindsight kind of stands out. Where they're talking about, Stephen Avery's checkered past and the incident with the cat and the incident with his wife and the incident with the cousin. And I think I think at a certain point, while it's incredibly compelling and it's definitely worth watching, they go so far out of their way to take one side, which in hindsight, as a business decision and, you know, to help their careers is great because they've riled up the masses way more than if they. Not that they have to portray it 50-50, but they really, it seems like, just showed, the defense's side of the story, you know, at the expense of anything the prosecution had to offer.
Well, that's an interesting comparison to Serial that you make, Akiva, because where Sarah Koenig's first person account in Serial is such a part of the story, and you start to wonder about, like, you know, is she have these real feelings like for Adnan, like, either like as a friend or whatever, and you really start to get invested into that relationship between the documentarian and also the subject in Adnan, and also is he manipulating her and what does she ultimately think, whereas this documentary, which is from Laura Riccardi and Maura Demos, that they're not on screen at all. And there's not even voiceover. That all of the information that's presented from editorial is via a card on the screen. And so I do think that sort of separates, sort of almost like presents it as fact more so than opinion, when it's still the opinion of the people that present it. And I feel like that people walked away from Serial where there was a lot of Adnan did it. I think Adnan is guilty. And I feel like there's much less with Making a Murderer. I feel like it's probably about like over 90% of people that walk away from Making a Murderer come away with that Stephen Avery is definitely innocent.
But again, I don't agree with Akiva's presentation that it's a biased presentation. I think obviously that sort of, you know, gives away sort of what we think about whether or not he did it. But I think, in other words, I think that we're conflating our opinions of the case and projecting that onto the documentary. I don't think that the documentary is biased. I think that, you know, I think both Akiva and I have probably read a lot of the articles about, you know, what didn't come into the show. And Ken Kratz, the prosecutor, his big complaint is, well, they didn't let me on the show, but they offered him multiple interviews and he turned them down. And frankly, I don't blame him. If you were him, would you have come on this show? There was no benefit for you to do so. You know, you've convicted the case, you've been successful, and now some filmmakers you've never heard of say, we're making a documentary about this. Why would you go on? Either they don't even make the show, or they make it and nobody hears about it, in case, why did you need to go on? And, or in the worst case scenario where they make it and it becomes really popular, at that point you can come and complain, oh, it was biased, they didn't have me on. So I don't think he should have gone on from his perspective, but that's been his big complaint. Well, they didn't have me on to present my side of the case. But, you know, I don't think it's biased. There are some pieces of evidence in both directions that they don't show, but they do show the evidence against him at certain points. It's just that the evidence against him is somewhat lacking, frankly.
And there's no way, just to add to that, that Kratz would have ever imagined that it could be 1% as popular as it is. So, you know, he didn't think that he'd really have, you know, outside maybe of his part of Wisconsin, he didn't think that he was really going to be dealing with backlash nationally.
You know, it's really just been a juggernaut to the point where I feel like there's very little buzz about Serial Season 2, which really, you know, paved the way for the success of Making the Murderer, to the point where Serial Season 2 is just sort of just background noise. Everybody's talking about this case.
Also, to be, you know, when they started filming this in 2005, how many, you know, avenues were there? How many networks were there where you could show this 10-part documentary that frankly is longer than it needs to be, right? You know, the only place possibly would have been something like maybe an HBO.
HBO turned it down. HBO saw it and said no.
And so in other words, the Netflix, which is ultimately where it is, it wasn't even a thing that existed when they first started making the documentary. And so Ken Kratz thought, oh, this will never show up on TV. He was probably right at the time, because the way it showed up was a way that he didn't even imagine existing at the time.
Okay, so let's just talk about some of the things that really caught your attention during the show. Alex, what sort of things were presented in the show that most made you feel like Mr. Avery is being railroaded?
Well, so I think these are the facts that everybody can agree to, if you're going to be fair. You know, there are some on one extreme who will say, oh, the, well, let me say, so these are the facts. I think number one, the police believe, honestly, in good faith, the police believe that he was guilty. They believed he was guilty of the first crime in 1985, and they believe that he was guilty of the murder in 2003. In fact, even though now there is zero doubt whatsoever with any fair-minded observer that he was not guilty of the rape in 1985, it's not like, oh, he was released on technicality. We know the guy who did it. Nevertheless, the police openly testified in court in the second case that they still believe Avery committed the rape in 1985. You know, and this is a police officer under oath. He's not lying. So they really believe that. So the police do believe that he committed the crime. I don't think that they were trying to frame an innocent man. And also, I think it's a fact that the police manipulated and or falsified some parts of the evidence. Now, again, why did they do that? There's two possibilities. Possibility number one is that Stephen Avery is guilty, which is what the police believe. The evidence to put him in prison wasn't a slam dunk for various reasons. And so they, you know, they manipulated the evidence a little bit to help guarantee that a dangerous murderer would not be on the streets. Possibly number two is that Avery's not guilty and he was found guilty because of the falsified evidence. I think that, you know, obviously there's both Stephen and there's Brendan. We didn't really mention Brendan, but Brendan is the 16-year-old nephew who's also found guilty of the crime and is also in jail. And in Brendan's case, there is literally zero evidence tying him to the crime whatsoever, other than the confession, which those who watched the show saw. The confession is very wishy-washy. The confession is, there's the confession. There's also a confession that he made, or there's the claim of a confession that he made to one of his cousins, who also backtracked and said that she was lying at the time based on, you know, sort of what the police pressured her to do. There's no physical evidence. There's nothing else tying him to it. The only thing is the confession. And, you know, Kratz says in his closing statement, he says, you know, innocent people don't confess. And we know, of course, that that's objectively not the case. In over 25% of cases where somebody has been convicted of a capital crime, there was a personal confession that was part of the state's evidence. So innocent people confess all the time. And especially, you know, when you have a 16-year-old who's mentally retarded and, you know, doesn't have counsel present and all that stuff. In Stephen's case, also the crime, there was no physical evidence whatsoever in the trailer. The trailer was messy. It was a disaster. And yet they do not find a single speck of blood, semen, saliva, anything from the victim there, even though she was supposedly there. We're meant to believe that somehow he managed to clean this place spotlessly. Every single square inch of that place completely spotless, even though there was garbage everywhere all over the place. And yet somehow he left the key to her car sitting right outside. So that, you know, that's very difficult to believe. The fact that that Andrew Colburn, who was one of the police officers who was possibly going to be liable under the false imprisonment for the rape, that he was the one who magically found the key after, you know, they had visited six times and they hadn't found it previously. He also, it seems pretty clear, he found the car that's found on Stephen Avery's lot. He found it somewhere else because he called it into the dispatcher, clearly reading off the number, and then it was moved to the Avery lot. It makes no sense if Avery did commit the murder, why he would have left the car there. This is a guy who's mentally retarded and can't figure anything out, and yet he's smart enough to remove every single speck of physical evidence from his trailer, and yet he's not smart enough to get rid of the car when he has a car crusher right on his lot, right next to, right there, and instead of crushing the car, he just leaves it there. So that's impossible to leave. As we said, the key was, I think, clearly planted, and I think the argument is, well, he still did it because of this other evidence, and it's just that we don't, you know, the police added extra evidence, which maybe they shouldn't have done, but there's enough independent of that. But my argument is that once the police are doing that, first, from a legal perspective, he should be found not guilty. And from a practical perspective, I just don't think he did it. The other thing is that the judge was very, very biased in this case. He did not allow, I mean, he turned down basically every single defense motion. He turned down curative jury instruction, which was basically to instruct the jury that they were not supposed to listen to the things that were outside the court case. In particular, Ken Krantz gave that highly inflammatory press conference where he talked in brutal terms about the sexual assault and rape and murder, including a number of things that they weren't even going to charge Stephen Avery with. And yet, he would not give a instruction to the jury that they should ignore that, even though that was not part of the evidence presented at the trial. He also turned down the defense's attempt to introduce alternate theories of the case, alternate possible suspects. Two of the suspects, frankly, there was the ex-boyfriend. And there was the roommate.
Well, to be clear, the four people that they considered suspects, if you read the documents, that's not the ex-boyfriend and that's not the roommate. So they're not even top four.
Yeah. So yeah, there's Bobby, who's Brendan's brother, and there's Scott Taddock, the dad, who we know they were there that day. They were each other's alibi that they left to go hunting, but they have no other alibis. And Taddock in particular has a history of violent behavior against women.
And Taddock tries to sell a rifle, right, you know, to a coworker right after the murder. And it has the same .22 that they find the bullet with.
Yeah. So I'm not here to throw a claim that the ex-boyfriend committed murder, but we do know, I mean, what we do know about him, we know that Teresa complained that she was getting, like, frequently getting these disturbing, scary voicemails. We know those voicemails got deleted. We know that the ex-boyfriend admitted that he knew the password and that he called into her voicemail and deleted it after she died. Now, again, that doesn't mean he killed her. If you were leaving inappropriate messages on someone's message machine and then they get murdered, you'd probably want to delete those messages even if you didn't do it because you don't want people to think that you did it, right? So I'm not saying he did it, but I'm saying that the judge didn't even allow any alternate theory to be brought into the case. And as we know, you know, especially when you're presenting a defense, you have to give, you can't just say, well, there's not enough evidence, because a jury is not gonna, you know, a jury's not gonna be sophisticated enough to say, well, there's not enough evidence, we're gonna find him not guilty. You have to give an alternate story. And they weren't allowed to do that.
All right, Alex, you brought up so many good points that I want to sort of try to backtrack. You started talking about the lack of blood evidence or DNA evidence on the Avery property. Watching the show, I found that to be the most convincing argument that they had of where is all of the blood from this woman, especially with the case that they're presenting from the prosecution of what he ultimately did to her. There's almost no way that you could imagine that this actually happened. Akiva, did this stand out to you?
Yeah, I think even the people in the Avery did it, or Avery probably did it, Avery might have did it camp, nobody who's reasonable about the case thinks that it happened in the trailer or in the warehouse, because there's no way Avery could have cleaned the blood there. You know, there's probably no way anyone could have cleaned the blood. So even if he did it, it has to be, you know, she leaves and he tracks her, or he takes her out to the car yard and, you know, and something happens there. Right. There's no way that either. And remember that Brandon and Steven are convicted under totally separate circumstances, because when Steven's convicted, Brandon's not there. And then when Brandon's convicted, obviously Brandon is involved, which is, you know, one of the craziest things in the whole story. But no, I don't think anybody believes that it could have happened according to either scenario that the prosecution lays out.
So Akiva, is your argument that while you think, so you're saying that you think he might have done it, but you would still agree that he should not have been found guilty, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I don't know how, the case is so filthy. There can't be really anybody who thinks that under this set of circumstances, even if you know deep down in your heart that there's a 95% chance he did it, or 100% chance he did it, it doesn't matter. You can't, there's no way to prove it. There's no way that the key is untainted, because how does the key have Steve's DNA but not have Teresa's DNA, a key that she's had for 4 years? There's so many insane things that are, beyond the scope of almost anybody to, like, you'd need four different types of DNA experts in here to even get to, start to scratch the surface of. But I mean, there's so many things that make sense. My argument for why, if you put a gun to my head and said, did he do it or not, I'd say yes, is because, much like when we talked about with Adnan, where it's like, well, if he didn't do it, he's the most unlucky guy ever, because there's 40 coincidences. What a coincidence that Stephen Avery, who is, let's backtrack for a minute, worse than any person you've ever met in your life, worse than anyone you've ever met has ever met in their life, right? Do you know anybody who's burned a cat? And to tie it to the jinx, Judge Jeanine Pirro likes to say that there's never been a serial killer in history who has not started by killing animals. And they underplay it in the documentary, but he douses the cat in gasoline. And
Stephen Avery does.
In oil. Stephen Avery does, not Jeanine Pirro.
But Akiva, the reverse isn't true. Just because every serial murderer also tortures animals doesn't mean that everybody who tortures animals.
Of course not. Of course not. But I just, it's not a good thing.
And this was as a young person?
I don't remember. No, he wasn't young. I mean, it was part of his 18-year jail sentence was for that, I believe.
No.
No, part of his initial, what was it, 5-year jail sentence, and the other part was when he runs his cousin off the road. Okay, so then he runs the cousin off the road, who we see at the beginning of the documentary, and we don't really hear from, I don't think, after that. And she, these are all character things, but she makes the claim that you almost forget about by episode 10, because you've almost become so defensive of Steven, like, that he's like sleeping with his wife or women and like in the middle of the street and doing all sorts of crazy things.
She doesn't make that claim. He claims that she was spreading that false rumor about him, and that's why he was angry at her.
I believe she says on the stand that she had once, maybe she recanted it, but I believe she says.
Let's not get too caught up on this part.
You're
of
right.
The case.
And then, okay, so then, fine. So he holds a female relative at gunpoint. He threatens his wife. His wife's life in a letter to his kids. All right. All of these things are really bad, but, and again, I'm not saying that he should, he shouldn't be found guilty. So let's not say that any of these things equal guilt. I'm just making a case. So you have a guy who we've established is not the best guy in the world. Okay. Now a woman who is creeped out by him comes to his trailer, probably doesn't want to see him.
Hold
because
on.
That's what
I'm not disagreeing with you, but just for people who might be hearing that for the first time, why are you saying that Teresa Halbach is creeped out by Stephen Avery?
Okay, so Teresa Halbach, and again, the problem is, like, part of this is sort of Ken Krantz, who you can't believe a word that comes out of his mouth, but the prosecution's case that you don't see much of in the trial in the documentary is that she complains to her boss that she doesn't want to go out to Avery's house anymore because he came out wearing a towel and she was creeped out by him. So he, he may have the hots for her, so to say. Then he calls her 3 times the day she goes missing. He star 67s her, which hides his identity. And we could go back and forth all day why he would want to do that. But it seems like a very bizarre thing to do for someone. And I understand the counter argument is, well, Stephen Avery's really famous at this point because in his town, he's the guy who went to jail for 18 years, came out, now just fell into this big sum of money, and he's already in a family that's really notorious in town. I don't hold a lot of water on some of the other things that people who are really in the Avery's guilty camp, like purchasing the handcuffs and stuff like that. To me, the defense doesn't even mention it in the court case. So if they're not mentioning it, if Kratz can't bring anything out of that, I can't bring anything out of that. The sweat DNA, and again, I'm the opposite of a sweat DNA expert, but the fact that his sweat DNA is found on the hood latch of her car and on his key, and the key, I don't even want to, the key is ridiculous. It's, who knows, her DNA is not on the key, so I guess who cares. But that really, the fact that how is his sweat DNA found on the hood latch of the car, that's really not great. So anyway, you have this woman who comes to his house, who's under four, you know, he wants her to come. He has a history of violence with women. There is a case against him within, you know, that he assaulted a member of his family that the prosecution never even brings to trial, mostly because he's already in jail for life and there's no reason to waste time and resources, you know, on a case for a family member is not really pressing them to do so. But, you know, so a person that very likely has, you know, history of violence against women, now magically this woman disappears and he's the last person who saw her. And you have, his nephew, saying that, you know, he saw it happen. And even if you're completely discounting what Brandon says, to me, there's just so many things that pile up one after the other that if he didn't do it, he is the unluckiest guy in the history of the world.
But you said like magically or I don't think it's magic or coincidence. It was intentional. The point is that the person who did commit this crime knew that Teresa's last appointment of the day was with him and knew that that would be the perfect day to kill her because of the fact that it would make him a suspect. And for the reasons you just mentioned, he would be a credible suspect and the police would be motivated to find him guilty for, you know, the other reasons, including, you know, the fact that they had $36 million hanging over their heads, et cetera, et cetera. So it wasn't a coincidence, right? Teresa could have been killed by the person who killed her any other day. This day was chosen in particular. Whether it was, you know, one of her family members or her ex-boyfriend who went into her voicemail and knew what her schedule was, or whether it was, you know, his brother-in-law and his nephew who knew and knew that she was coming and saw her come and testify that they saw her come. You know, those people knew. So it's not like, oh, it's just bad luck. Like, it was intentional, I think. That's the whole point, right? That's part of the defense's argument.
See, the problem for me with both of those things is that I feel like with Stephen Avery, if you were going to try to frame him, and let's say it was like we're trying to make the case that, okay, this was some sort of like inside job and somebody who was like a crooked cop wants to make sure that he can't collect on this money. Like, well, why did poor Teresa Halbach have to pay the price for this and have to be the person to get murdered? So I don't really know what the motive was just to take her out. And if somebody wanted Teresa Halbach dead, it feels like that this would be quite a stretch for them to know that Stephen Avery was going to be the person to take the fall on it and that the county wanted to get him for something so badly because of the court case. Like, I feel like it would be hard to find one person who had both motives.
Well, again, and to be clear, as I think I said before, I don't think that the cops were trying to frame him, and I certainly don't think that the cops were committing murder, although let's also remember that one of the cops did say, he said, why would we frame him? We could have just killed him. So one of these crooked cops did testify that they wouldn't have a problem killing an innocent person. No, but I don't think that, and I don't think that's a fair accusation. I think the cops honestly believed he did it. I think the person who did it, they might not have been motivated by the $36 million necessarily, although remember, as Akiva said, this was like the biggest news story in that part of Wisconsin. I think they were motivated by they wanted to kill Teresa for one reason or another, and they knew that he would be a suspect because of the fact that he was the last one on her, that he was the last one on her schedule that day, right? Whether they were, you know, sophisticated enough to know that it was the $36 million, that it would be, you know, financially to the benefit of the county for it to be him, whether they knew that or not, I don't think is relevant, right? If you commit a crime and there's a guy in your neighborhood who's the last person on somebody's schedule that day and who has a history of committing crimes, that could be enough right there.
Yeah, I mean, here's my problem. And I say this all the time. With conspiracy theories, there's always the assumption that people who we learn are very dumb or we assume are very dumb all of a sudden become the world's biggest masterminds. The same people who hate the president of the United States, be it a Democrat or Republican, they're generally the same people who come up with conspiracy theories, how that person is so evil and they're plotting, you know, all these, you know, this worldwide destruction when they also don't think they could tie their own shoelaces. So to me, it's a team of bumbling idiots that we see on the prosecution side. And, you know, the four main suspects, especially if Stephen doesn't do it, like the defense's top four, who are all, you know, living there and are Avery family members, there are no masterminds. Like, we see this throughout the series. There's no masterminds there who are pulling this off, leaving their tracks, you know. So it just leaves the possibilities so shallow that there's anybody, the only people in the whole case smart enough to do this are the lawyers and the or his defense attorneys, and they didn't do it.
But so, what conspiracy theory are we proposing? We're not proposing any conspiracy theory. We're proposing somebody killed and murdered somebody. That's it. What's the conspiracy there?
Well, because they're plotting. So they're choosing a patsy afterwards to take the fall because there's no way it happened the way they're saying it happened.
And, the way the prosecution said it happened.
But the way the prosecution's saying it's happening, and that, you know, if it did happen like that, they're clearly rearranging evidence. They're not finding a key. We all admit the fifth time, you know, 200 people walk past a bed. That's not happening. So I don't know.
With the key, though, I believe, and I could be wrong about this, I thought they like moved a bookcase and then the key came out. Like, I don't think the key was supposedly laying on the floor the whole time.
Right. But also, who finds the key? It's, you know, it's right. Magically, it's Colburn.
Yeah. And so, well, let's talk about some of those other guys that are the real people in this case who are somewhat vilified throughout the series. And I've been reading about how that, you know, Ken Kratz has like a page up on Yelp, and people are going there and sort of like really just like, you know, publicly shaming him, or at least online shaming people that are involved with this case. Is that one of the dangers with doing something like this, Akiva?
What, to shame Kratz?
Yeah. I mean, these are real people that are involved with this. It's not like some like, you know, movie bad guy.
It's true. But, you know, there are certain people like I feel like the holdbacks are completely off limits. Nobody should be contacting them. Nobody should be writing to them on Facebook or calling their house or emailing them or showing up at their door. They have to be off limits. I think the Averys, you know, need to be off limits unless they want you to, you know, you can help them. But these are not people you should be, you know, stalking, be it cyber or otherwise. But I think at worst, people hate. More than anything, when people in positions of power abuse that power, and they love catching them for it. I think that Kratz, in particular, for whatever reason, is so detestable that he's going up there. The press conferences are so abhorrent, and he's bragging about what's going on. And so the fact that he gets, you know, one of the interesting things about this story is, whereas shows like this, such as The Jinx, like have a home run, you know, in the final episode, there's no... Like the highlights in terms of like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened, are probably the interrogations of Brandon, which happened, you know, relatively early in the series. And there's almost, it's all darkness in the last few episodes for Brandon and Steven. So really the only comeuppance in the whole, you know, final, you know, I guess you could be happy that Steven has a girlfriend, but for whatever reason, people like that always seem to have girlfriends. The only comeuppance you get is, you know, Kratz gets busted basically for, you know, the text messages and, you know, texting basically, you know, a victim of you know, domestic violence and, you know, it is beyond. So Kratz, it's hard to
he really comes off like a bad guy.
He is the villain here. The difference is that Kratz, at least job is to, you know, prosecute, you know, Stephen Avery.
I watched the show with my wife who's not a lawyer. And one thing she said to me was, you know, if he's not guilty, which it seems like he's not guilty, at least based on the show, why is everybody, it seems, in the state of Wisconsin conspiring against him? So there's sort of two things that maybe non-lawyers don't realize, which we need to sort of establish. Number one, you know, this is going to be a little bit impolitic, but state judges are a joke. Federal judges, you know, every single federal judge, whether, you know, it's Earl Warren on the left or Antonin Scalia on the right, every federal judge, not just on the Supreme Court, but you know, at the district level, is appointed by the President of the United States. And every federal judge is a very highly trained, highly respected individual, even if you disagree with them politically. State judges, like in Wisconsin, for example, every single state judge all the way up to the Supreme Court is elected. So how the hell are voters in Wisconsin or anywhere else supposed to vote on somebody? They don't know what they're doing. What are you basing a judge on? It's officially supposed to be a nonpartisan election because you don't want somebody campaigning and saying, oh, I'm going to put, you know, abortion providers in jail. You know, like you're not supposed to prejudge a case. But practically speaking, what are they basing it on? So state judges tend to not be the most sophisticated judges or lawyers, and they're not particularly good. Now, the other thing is, like, what is the role of a lawyer? So,
by the way, before you say what you say, just to prove your point further, who is a judge in Wisconsin? Len Kaczynski.
Yeah. but so that you said, well, he, you know, he was doing his job. So the role of a lawyer, like a defense lawyer's job, is to protect your client at all costs, right? It is. And that's why when you're doing defense, you're not supposed to ask your client, you know, did you do it or not? Because if they say they did do it, well, then you can't provide an adequate defense because obviously you can't lie as a lawyer. But your job is to look out for your client's interests, right? If this was a civil case, you know, if the Hallback family brought a wrongful death suit against the Averys, in that case, then the lawyer for the Hallbacks his role is to represent them, and he should do whatever he possibly can to get convince the court that Avery, you know, would be, you know, civilly liable for the wrongful death of Teresa Halbach. But a prosecutor for the government, your job is to seek the truth. Your client isn't an individual. Your client is not the victim. Your client is the state, right? It's the state of Wisconsin against Stephen Avery. And that includes every resident of the state, including, frankly, Stephen Avery, his family, right? Your job is not to find Stephen Avery guilty. Your job is to find the correct person guilty. And so that's why, and that's why I do give them the benefit of the doubt. I do think that they honestly thought it was him, right? But they went to extra legal lengths to convince the jury that he's guilty, whether it's falsifying evidence, whether it's saying false things like in their closing statements, et cetera, whether it's, you know, manipulating the jury with the press conferences, et cetera. All those things that they did, I don't think that's his job, because his job is to represent the state, not to represent Teresa Halbach. His job is not to find Stephen Avery guilty. It's to find the person who did the crime guilty.
Yeah. And so, all right. So that turns this around, I think, to me, the people who, and again, I don't think anybody should be, you know, I don't mind leaving a bad Yelp review, but the people who really should be, you know, held to their feet to the fire here. And that's the people who were being, paid or, you know, trusted to protect Stephen and Brandon. And, you know, most notably, that's Len Kaczynski and that's O'Kelly. And, you know, O'Kelly writes an email. Again, these are the people that he's ostensibly trying to get off. He writes an email to the lawyer, Len Kaczynski, saying, "I can find no good in any member. These people are pure evil. A friend of mine suggested this is a one branch family tree. Cut this tree down. We need to end the gene pool here." These are the guys who are on their side.
Right.
Yeah. And to me, you know, you said that Kratz is sort of the biggest villain in the show. To me, and maybe just because I'm a lawyer, to me, Len Kaczynski is by far the worst, the biggest villain in the show with Michael O'Kelly as his sidekick. And the strangest thing to me is I can't even figure out what Kaczynski's motivation is, right? Like, why is Kaczynski trying so hard to screw over his own client, right? There's that whole ridiculous thing where O'Kelly sort of forces Brendan to confess in a way that he didn't do it. And, you know, he lies to Brendan. This wasn't in the documentary, but he lied to Brendan about a polygraph, which he administered to him and told Brendan that he failed it, even though he didn't. But the part that doesn't make sense to me, so first of all, this judge, Fox, he denies the motion for Kaczynski to be dismissed, which is insane. And he only finally later allows the dismissal when he discovers that Kaczynski arranged for Brendan to be interrogated again, without Kaczynski present. The part that I can't figure out is if you're Kaczynski and you're going to extreme lengths to screw over your own client, as you obviously are, and you don't want to be dismissed from the case, right? Like my wife was saying when we watched, oh, maybe he wants to get off the case. He just wants to go do something else. But then when the judge tries to dismiss him, he argues against that. But the part that doesn't make sense to me is why didn't he at least bother to show up for the confession the next day after the O'Kelly, right? Like, why didn't he at least show up for that? Because that made no sense to me. Is he trying to look corrupt and evil? Because it is obvious that you never allow, when you are represented by counsel never allows their client to be interrogated without him being present. So why didn't Kaczynski at least show up and just sit in the corner and twiddle his thumbs? Like, that made no sense to me. What's his motivation throughout this show? I can't figure it out.
Yeah, to me, because even if he got, right. So you're basically, even if he was getting paid off, and we're not accusing them of that, but even if he was literally being paid off or they, you know, they're basically hampering him on purpose with the worst possible attorney, there's no way he would be this obvious in his neglect. So to me, the only answer is that Kaczynski is both A, incredibly stupid, and B, probably very lazy and probably was watching, you know, The Price is Right. He didn't want to, you know, go to the interrogation and sit there for 3 hours. Literally. I mean, I'm almost giving him the benefit of the doubt that he is both incredibly dumb and, you know, like just indifferent or lazy.
Okay. What about the two breakout superstars of this? And those were the defense attorneys for Stephen Avery. And these guys are basically like, I'm reading like BuzzFeed quizzes of which one of these two guys should you go out with now. Everybody is all abuzz about Strang and Buting.
Yeah, I mean, to me, these guys are basically, celebrities. They are the heroes of the story. It's a little subtle, in the sense that the show really, they don't get a hero's edit per se from the documentarians, but what you're watching, you're like, oh my god, these guys are incredible. Like, they're not even trying hard to put them over. They're just so good. And again, their hands are tied because the judge is allowing them to do so few things, you know, like suggest possible other you know, people who may have done instead of Steven. There, you know, there's a lot of things that the jury didn't get to see. And really, ultimately, one thing we haven't discussed yet, the more I read about this case, the number one reason why Steve Avery loses is the jury. And we see very little about the jury because they purportedly signed this pact of silence between the 12 of them that they'll never speak. But we do hear that, you know, accusations that two of them had, you know, were relatives of people, you know, basically higher ups in the county who were never under any circumstance going to find him, you know, anything other than guilty.
So what we do hear, Jerry Buting tell the family after the case that seven of the jurors initially want him to be found not guilty, but that there were two or three. I thought there were three, Akiva, you might be right. There were two. They were adamant from the beginning that he was guilty before the case and they weren't going to budge. And ultimately, they agreed to compromise whereby he would be found guilty of the first count and not guilty of the second count, which obviously makes no internal logic. You know, there's no consistency there. The only juror that we hear from on the show is the juror who had to leave because of family emergency. And he clearly thought that he should have been found not guilty. And he was very, very distressed in the show about his role. But now, you know, breaking news yesterday, we just heard one of the jurors came out and did publicly say that he also felt, he or she, because they haven't come out with their name for fear of retribution, but he or she also felt that Stephen Avery was not guilty and that he was framed, in fact. But yet again, he or she said that they were basically forced by the two or three who wouldn't budge and they were going to sit there for months on end unless they turned around and made a compromise and found him guilty of the first count.
It's also worth mentioning, because again, and these are things that are sort of like breaking today or yesterday, but in case somebody thinks that, oh, this person just saw the documentary, you know, isn't really familiar with the last 10 years of the case, sees the documentary and is like, oh, sure, I made a mistake. This person contacted the filmmakers before it aired, I believe in November, according to CNN.
I have so many different questions from the audience for you guys about the series. And let's just start with one from Peggy, which I think is probably maybe the biggest question coming out of this. What's the best case outcome from this documentary shedding light on serious flaws in our justice system? Is there any chance of this moving the needle on setting a standard of how police interrogations should be conducted? Alex, do you think that something like this has maybe doesn't ultimately do anything for Steve Avery, but does it possibly, is this the beginning or is this the continuation of a movement to sort of right wrongs in the justice system?
Well, you know, the way that wrongs are righted in the justice system, frankly, is from cases that go wrong and then courts eventually establish new rules. So, for example, that's what we have to thank for the fact that all interrogations are now filmed. And that's how we get to see this interrogation. There's also a lot having to do with whether you can interrogate somebody without a lawyer present when they're underage, when they're mentally retarded. And I don't use that term as like a slur or slang. I use it because, you know, it's a legal term of art to be mentally retarded. To suffer from, you know, deficient intelligence has a legal definition, and usually it's defined, and there's, you know, there's some wiggle room, but usually it's defined as a IQ of, usually the cutoff is 70 or possibly 75, and Stephen Avery's IQ was 70, and Brendan's IQ was 73.
Well, I think they say between 69 and 73, which may be, Wisconsin has like weird laws from the very little I've read about that, but, you know, Brandon, and we haven't discussed Brandon enough maybe, but he... you know, the idea that this kid is sitting in jail is really all we should be talking about. Like, Steven, for better or worse, is a grown man. Like, Brandon, we've let a child, basically, who is, you know, just barely 16, go to... They say to him that, you know, just tell us and you'll go free. And then he literally tells them, you know, confesses to a rape and a murder that he's a part of. And he's like, all right, I really have a project, sixth period. I really have to go. And, you know, he still thinks, you know, a week or two later, you know, I need to be home by WrestleMania. So, I mean, to me, like, if, you know, if anyone is coming out, like, you say, like, the president can't pardon him, like, we almost have to, like, something has to happen. Can we break him out of jail? Like, this is insane.
Well, yes, but Rob is saying, forget about these two. It's sort of like the broader possible benefits of this. And it does shine light. And I think, again, I think there is value because realistically, you know, in like the Black Lives Matter movement, for example, although there's many people who are sympathetic, it's, you know, if you're not a minority, if you're not a racial minority, you look at this and you say, well, that's really unfortunate. But this show shows that it could happen to you even if you're not. You know, it could happen to anybody. Hopefully the ultimate lesson for this, if it's not obvious enough, is never speak to a police officer ever under any circumstances ever without a lawyer present. It, no matter if you have nothing to do with the case, You never say anything because it can always somehow come up against you. But I think that people like most of the listeners or Rob and Akiva and I, we know that. The problem is that when you have somebody like Brendan Dassey, he doesn't know that. And so, and people like Brendan Dassey aren't going to hear about this show. So people like that, you know, hopefully won't learn that lesson. But I mean, that lesson needs to be drilled in. You never, ever, 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 ever speak to the cops without a lawyer present. I mean, that could not be more explicit.
Well, under any circumstances or when you're talking about a specific crime? Like when you're in a situation like a Brendan Dassey.
I'm not saying don't say good morning to a police officer on the street. I'm pro police officer. I don't dislike the police. I'm saying that anything related to a crime, even if you're not a suspect, even if you're just a witness, because again, remember when these people first spoke with him, Brendan certainly wasn't a suspect. He was a witness at most. And Stephen also, and the police went out of their way in the beginning to say that Stephen was not a suspect. And by the way, the fact that Stephen spoke to the police without counsel present in 2005, after having already been the victim of a wrongful conviction and spent 18 years in jail, is mind boggling, but I think further exposes, frankly, the low intelligence we're dealing with there, because of anybody, you'd think he would have learned the lesson, and yet he still spoke to them and further incriminated himself, as it turns out.
Okay, let's take another question. This is from Jasmeet Sidhu, who says, what was the biggest WTF moment for you guys when watching? Was it the punctured blood vial? Andrew Colburn's calling in of the license plate 2 days before the car was found, Colburn ignoring the detective's phone call in the 90s about having the wrong man in custody when Brendan Dassey was being coerced into a false confession by his own defense investigator, no Teresa DNA on blood being found anywhere in the garage or the bedroom. Sorry, the whole thing drives me mad. All right, what's the one biggest WTF piece from this? Alex, what about you?
Those are all good ones. I think there was when that police officer says, oh, we could have just killed him. That's pretty bad. That sketch artist, Eugene Cush, that he still proudly shows off the sketch that falsely accused Stephen Avery of the crime.
That was like Nathan For You scene, basically.
Yeah, that was crazy. I think also probably when we learn that Andrew Colburn was told by detectives in Brown County in like 1994 that they had the wrong guy in jail and that he didn't know anything about and that he did nothing about it. And then he only filed the report about it the day after Stephen was released 8 years later.
Yeah.
That might be it to me. Because, you know, that these cops are like, for whatever reason, they just really have it out for this family from the first.
Akiva, what about you?
For me, first, the fact that Stephen Avery doesn't own underwear was a WTF moment for me. That was pretty shocking. But I didn't know that was a thing. But I think...
in the show?
Yeah. I know. There's some funny moments. I mean, to me, but... and then there's just shocking things like, you know, Brandon and his mom not understanding what the word inconsistencies mean, just to be really, hits home. But, and Chester hit on a lot of the good WTF moments. But for me, it's just the biggest home run in the whole series that you can't believe is on tape is watching them turn Brandon around from, you know, Brandon not answering the questions to them literally leading him on and then just giving up and, you know, and giving him the answers, basically, in the Brandon confession scenes. To me, those are the biggest WTF moments of the series.
I feel like for me, when they go to look at the vial of blood that Stephen Avery had in the evidence locker and they see that the thing in the seal has been broken, it's been cracked open and there's like a syringe hole in the top of the blood. And I felt like that was very frustrating, that whole sequence about the and then testing the blood. And they came in with sort of like a potentially Fugazi test of the EDTA in the blood. I mean, did the prosecution ever have a defense for what happened to that blood evidence from the first case?
Well, they didn't need to, because the reason why the defense was introducing that was to make the argument that it was planted. And then and the way they responded to that was with the EDTA test. And then they brought in their expert and then the defense brought in their expert that said, look, the science here is extremely weak. At best, it can fail to prove a positive, but it can't produce a negative. And there's a reason the FBI doesn't use these tests, because they've been documented to produce false negatives. There's two cases ever when it's been used, which is this case and O.J. Simpson. So I think that they don't need to explain whether or not the blood was tampered with. All they do is present an argument that blood wasn't in the car. And which is why it would have been tampered with, right?
Jim Schiff wants to know, really looking forward to the podcast. What does the panel think about the fact that the two-woman search party was able to locate the RAV4 almost immediately upon entering the Avery property? Yeah, that did seem pretty sketchy too, that the woman was able to go directly to where the RAV4 was, that she was given a camera by the leader of the search party, like, hey, I think you should go look over there. Nobody else was given a camera.
Well, so this was one of the things, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it, it was the ex-boyfriend who's the one who was leaving the search party and who told her to go look right there and gave her the camera, right?
Yeah, that guy, and they never went back to that guy.
Yeah, so we know that he knew her voicemail password. We know he deleted her messages. We know that he helped find the car. It does seem very sketchy to me.
Let's see if that guy has a Yelp.
No. We're leaving these.
I found this Facebook page, but we could leave him alone.
Jake Goldblum says, do you think that the evidence is circumstantial? And do you think that we're nuts for thinking he's innocent? Apparently, Akiva does.
I mean, are we nuts for are they nuts for thinking he's innocent? No, because you saw the documentary.
Yes.
I mean, there's no, like, if all you're doing is seeing the documentary, you have no reason to think anything other than this is, you know, he was framed.
So, Akiva, I just want to wrap my head around your position on the case. So do you feel like that Steve Avery did it, but the case against him is bogus? Is it an injustice that he's in jail?
Yes, it is definitely an injustice that he was jailed because he didn't have a fair, I don't think he had a fair trial, but the circumstances surrounding, you know, the things that he's accused of his trial at trial are so outrageous that no, he should not be in jail. No question, he shouldn't be in jail.
Okay, Rachel.
And Brendan, obviously, right?
Obviously, Brendan shouldn't be near jail. I mean, even if Brendan did it, probably shouldn't be in jail. He should be somewhere else.
Yeah, he was a mentally deficient minor.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't officially a minor, but I think it was just days after his 16th birthday. Like, if that's the best we could do
18 is the cutoff, but the point is that prosecutors have the right to charge somebody as an adult.
Right, but if he was 15, I don't think that would have happened necessarily.
I don't think there's a difference between 15. Look, there's been cases where they have kids who are 11 and 12 years old.
Okay, fine. All right, that's fair. But I mean, you look at him, there's no... And the problem with cases like this, I'd imagine, is that by the time it gets to trial, especially his trials afterwards, you know, the jury is seeing basically a man because it's been a couple years. Whereas, you know, if he's tried right away or at least tried first, he's, you know, he looks younger and baby-faced.
Curtis Barton says, assuming that every criminal lawyer who watches this says it's true, that this is not uncommon, what scares you more, yourself or a loved one being accused of something you didn't do or being picked to serve on a jury where the sentence is either death or mandatory life and the fate of someone who might be innocent is in your hands? I think I'd rather be on the jury.
Yeah,
obviously. I mean, if those are the options.
Not really much of a choice there, but
isn't that like that's the Jerry Seinfeld stand-up bit about, you know, the people's biggest fear is public speaking and second biggest fear is death, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which means at a funeral, you'd rather be in the casket than giving the eulogy.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'd rather be the juror finding somebody guilty than the guy who the jury is finding guilty.
Now, if Stephen Avery actually is innocent, is there anything that you feel like, Alex, that the defense didn't do?
Based on the show, I don't think so. I think the defense did a good job. I think the problem was that you were dealing with a jury. The jury pool was polluted to begin with. And in particular, two or three of the jurors had decided the case beforehand. And remember, when you're doing jury selection, you only have a certain number of dismissals. And so they ran out of them because this is in Manitowoc County. These are all locals. And, you know,
we can only imagine who the six people they were able to nix were. I mean, they were like literally probably, you know, Hallback family members.
And also when you're considering the evidence on both sides and the question is, well, who's the liar here? And it is hard to believe that police officers are liars, especially in a small town, you know, where police do get the benefit of the doubt much more. You know, Ken Kratz, I think it was in the closing statement where he says, you know, these are family men and, you know, and he's making James Lank and Andrew Colburn look like sort of innocent victims who are being accused of terrible things. Let's also remember, obviously, Steve Avery's also, you know, is a citizen. But I understand why he was found guilty. And I don't think that it was the defense counsel's fault. Now, in order to bring it to federal court, you have to make an argument, which I think like they're doing now with Brendan, why the state court is the wrong venue for this. But otherwise, in state court, I mean, it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, so there's nowhere further they can go in the state of Wisconsin.
Jonathan Shapiro wants to know, I keep thinking about the irony that if he just listened to Len Kaczynski and accepted the plea deal from Kratz, he would be out of prison pretty soon instead of when he's almost 60. Do you think that he should have accepted or sought a plea, or is this a case of hindsight being 20/20? And this is referring to Brendan.
I mean, he was innocent in his mind. Then he, you know, he's got to take the plea. And even if he's then there's no reason he should take the plea. To me, there's no circumstance where, like you said, hindsight's 20/20. There's no circumstance where Brendan, who assumes, like, even if his uncle somehow did it, that he's not involved. Like, there's no reason why he's taken a bunch of years in jail, you know, and getting, you know, ruining his childhood.
And also, as we saw, you know, with the first case, when Steven doesn't get out of jail for 18 years, he can never be paroled, because part of the parole process, if you have to express remorse, and if you didn't do something, how do you express remorse for something that you honestly didn't do, right? I mean, in hindsight, I guess the question is valid, because Brendan would have been out of jail, and Brendan's testimony would have been used against Steven, who would have had more counts brought against him, but Steven's in jail anyways. So the personal outcome for Brendan would have been better in hindsight, but there's no way that he could have or should have or would have done that just for that reason.
All right, so where does this case ultimately go from here, Alex?
So, based on what I've read, I'll say this. In episodes 9 and 10, there is a modicum of optimism once you see that Brendan, who never had any kind of decent counsel whatsoever, all of a sudden has, this organization from New York who's coming in, who specifically their specialty is confessions that come from minors. And all of a sudden, it looks like there's a real chance here. But then again, they go to state court, and even though they basically acknowledge the fact that Brendan had no competent counsel in the first place, the state court still rules against him. So now where it goes next is to federal court. I haven't heard, and Akiva, you can tell me if some of the research you've done has shown that there is any movement here, but I haven't heard that there's any further movement for Steven. The way the show ends is that he's, you know, doing his own legal research and writing his own briefs by hand and submitting them, and, you know, which obviously is completely hopeless. If his great two lawyers couldn't do anything for him, then the idea that somebody with no education whatsoever and a 70 IQ is going to handwrite his way out of prison is obviously impossible. But has there been any movement, for Steven to, is there a new argument or some reason why he could get a hearing in federal court?
I do think that ultimately what seems to be happening is that people are picking holes and they're going to try and, you know, chisel the best argument they can and sort of use that to get a retrial based on, like he was tried under some, you know, there was some sort of false circumstance.
But he's exhausted unless you can prove that there's a new piece of evidence that the prosecution withheld.
Right, that's what I'm saying. So what the question is, what is this going to bring up, you know, with hundreds of, you know, tens of thousands of people looking, you know, all over the place and reading the transcripts and trying to find something. But I don't know, you know, I'm not a legal expert, but to me, at face value, it seems pretty hopeless right now.
So is your prediction 10 years from now, 2025, are Brendan and Steven, are they in jail or not?
Well, yeah, Steven, I think, is in jail 10 years from now. I'd say Brendan probably, but he's got a better chance of getting out, it seems.
Rob, what about you?
As we all know in Hollywood, they love to reboot things. So I think that we get a second trial going. Netflix foots the legal bill because we need to reboot Making a Murderer for season 2. And then we get everybody back. We get all the lawyers back here for the second season. It's a huge deal, becomes the highest rated series on Netflix, and the court finds him guilty again, and then everybody riots.
That's it's an optimistic outlook you have there.
Like, imagine you sit like, oh my God, Dean Strang has signed on for Making a Murderer season 2. This is huge.
The documentarians are still filming. They're still talking to Avery. So it's not impossible. I mean, it took them 10 years to get this down, so it's probably years off, but it's not inconceivable that we see more of the story in the future from them.
Well, because you have to have season 2, right?
Oh boy.
That's the retrial. Season 2 is the retrial. That's easy.
I mean, you know, to get serious for a second, I think like I don't see any sort of happy ending for them. As hard it is to think about, the reason why this is striking, a chord with so many people is because the bad outcome happened. And at heart, we sort of, you know, we're rooting for the underdog and we want them to be successful. But we're going up against City Hall here. It seems so bleak.
I have to feel like that there's going to be movement on Brendan Dassey before Steven Avery.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and listen, Adnan's getting a little, some hearings and stuff like that.
Oh, he got screwed.
Well, why did he get screwed? Oh, you mean because now nobody cares about him anymore?
Nobody cares about Adnan.
His case got heard to the point where he's, you know, there's been some movement on it. And most people think he's guilty. So, you know,
Do they? Who, is that true?
I think over 50% think that he did it.
Because you said that you thought at the end of Serial Season 1 that you thought that the show was presenting it as if he probably did it. And I thought she presented it as he probably didn't. But maybe I misremember because, you know, it was over a year ago.
Was Adnan Syed already sentenced on October 31st, 2005?
Oh, no. Now we're getting crazy here.
Okay.
Yeah, he was.
Okay, good.
He was all in right, jail.
So he has an alibi.
Yes.
He Adnan was accounted for. All right. Well, this was a very fun discussion about Making a Murderer. The fun thing about this is that, you know, there's new information coming out all the time. And so many people are into it. Celebrities are into it. This is like the new in thing to do. Jeff Probst was even tweeting out a change.org petition to help out Stephen Avery. Can you believe that, Akiva?
Yeah, I mean, you could have had Probst and Baldwin, and you had Wienerker and Chester. I don't know if you made the right call here.
Yeah, Alec Baldwin is in on it. I mean, everybody is talking about the show.
Alec Baldwin gave me a lecture at a Harvard Law School once, so he's a legal scholar.
Yeah.
He comes every year now, actually. He comes every year and speaks about father's rights in family law.
All right, well, let's see what happens if there's any more movement on the Making a Murderer here in these next couple of weeks. If people want to get a hold of these guys, of course, you could follow Akiva on Twitter. He's at Keeve26. And Alex, what is your Twitter account?
AChester99.
AChester99. Of course, you can listen to Akiva and Alex every week as they discuss everything that's happening in the NFL on the 32 Fans in 32 Days podcast. You can search for it on iTunes. Of course, you could continue to hear Akiva every week on our Seinfeld post-show recap here on postshowrecaps.com. And also, Akiva joined me on Rob Has a Podcast this past week to simulate a season of Survivor with all the NFL quarterbacks on robhasawebsite.com. All right. Let's look and see your comments. Hopefully we don't get, flamed too badly by anybody here on postshowrecaps.com. And if there's enough questions, that I would love to reconvene with you guys at some point.
Yeah, this case really inflames passions in people. So even if we did a decent job, we'll get flamed. And if we didn't, we'll just get completely annihilated.
Okay. Well, I hope that we were at least fair to both sides of the case in this discussion of the series, which I think that we probably did an injustice to talking about just how captivating the series was. I was really glued to it for 10 episodes, and it's the mark of something that is really interesting. So great job by the creators and by Netflix, and hopefully we have more Making a Murderer to talk about in the future.
Ding.
All right, take care, everybody. Bye.